This podcast is for educational purposes only. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect the official policy or position of the Ted Stevens Center, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
But let me start with this, Mead. Alaska's location at the crossroads of the Pacific and the Arctic regions make it a unique asset to U.S. and global security. How would you describe Alaska's geopolitical significance in both historical and modern terms, or perhaps it is viewed from the lens of an investor, somebody who wants to do something in this region?
Well, Matt, I've always thought of Alaska as important, not only for what it is, but where it is. The what it is the resources we've got, tremendous fish, tremendous energy, tremendous opportunities for tourism. The where it is where the air crossroads of the world. We're the third or fourth largest air cargo port in the world, depending on what day it is. We are the center of what could happen in Arctic shipping with a newly accessible Arctic Ocean. We are a new pathway for faster fiber optic cables from Europe to Asia and North America to Asia. So we have a very important role in civil commerce in these areas, and a very important parallel role in the military. The reason why we have so many fighter jets based in Alaska is because they can be in either the European theater, the North American theater, or the Asian theater in about the same amount of time. We have, we're known as part of the third island chain if there were a problem in the Pacific. And frankly, I was having a meeting yesterday with the Alaska National Guard Joint Staff on where we would be the first problem, and the Bering Strait. It's used by U.S. The Arctic Ocean is used by U.S. submarine forces today to move resources around, and you don't have to go through the Panama Canal or the Suez Canal, so people, so you can do it secretly.
Right.
You think the Russians don't do that? Mm-hmm. They certainly do. You think the Chinese aren't looking for that capability? They certainly are. Mm-hmm. And so the Bering Strait is really the Bering Gate in any kind of Pacific conflict, Indo-Pacific conflict that we got to pay attention to. So it's a big deal for investment in bringing about the parts of the global transportation system that we are naturally part of. And it's a big goal for the military.
So I want to pull on a lot of that. Investment is not new to the Arctic by any sense of the imagination, and is certainly necessary for the future of the region in order for it to maintain or to be leveraged as a asset for Arctic. You mentioned some of the reasons why. We have the highest concentrations of fifth generation aircraft here in the state of Alaska. We go on with other examples. But maybe to get there, to talk about what we're going to do in the future, what investments we can make, how we can cooperate with partners and allies, maybe we need to look back. Because you were part of some really important, we'll call it evolutions in U.S. Arctic policy, both in government positions and business positions, dating back to previous presidential administrations and governorships, where the state of Alaska really served at this nexus of domestic policy and foreign policy. And you served kind of at the tail end of the Cold War, and some, not to date you, but to provide, to point out that you have experience, because we're kind of seeing a little bit of history all over again. So maybe you could start back in sharing sort of where we've came from.
Sure. Well, I was mentored by Alaska's second governor, Wally Hickel, who was also Interior Secretary. And I had the chance to work with him on and off since 1974 until he died in 2010. In the early 80s, I won a Commonwealth North Fellowship and traveled across the North American Arctic, went to every major hard rock mine that the Canadians have as a precursor to us building the Red Dog Mine. That was a huge investment in Alaska, a huge investment of the state of Alaska in the road. And today we're the largest producer of lead and zinc in the country. And it all comes, and it has done a huge amount for the prosperity of natives in the region and Seven Eyes sharing across the across Alaska. But it's also, 7i is how the Native corporations share with other Native corporations. But it's also been an incredibly important strategic asset for the United States. And as we go look at rare earth minerals and other things, the important thing is knowing how to make investments in Alaska and the Arctic work is very important.
Yeah.
Governor Hickel and I had an opportunity in 1981 with his wife and his son, Carl. We went across the Soviet Union as guests of the Politburo. And we decided at the beginning, it's not a political trip. The Russians tried to make it that way. You know, when a coal miner started lecturing us about neutron bombs, we said, you know, we smiled and, you know, drank their tea. But the point I'm getting at here is that the Russians in the Arctic were doing many of the same things that we were working on in Alaska at the time. Hydroelectric projects, plywood projects, coal mines, and some things. And they actually positioned themselves better to serve the Asian market than we did. And I learned a lot from that.
At the time.
At the time, yeah. I then found myself in the, again, just coming out of business school, was vice president and treasurer of Yukon Pacific, which was an attempt to sell natural gas. And I couldn't understand why we were getting such attention from the Reagan White House. Mm-hmm. Figured out later, we were part of Reagan's plan to deny Russia cash flow by pushing Alaska gas and Alaska oil into the market. I worked with the Reagan White House to get us the freedom to do that.
So even back in the 80s, we're talking energy security and its relation.
Yeah.
Arctic energy, Indo-Pacific, great power competition.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, there was an attempt when the Cold War ended, and we actually used the Arctic to help end the Cold War. Reagan and Gorbachev got together. There was a toast about a woman who had swum between the Diomedes. We went to the White House and said, here's a thing we can do to open the border with Russia to build as a confidence building measure at the end of the Cold War. And then frankly, we found ourselves in a morass. Many Alaskans, many Americans found themselves in a morass of trying to figure out how to make Russia an investable place and not a kleptocracy. And you can see how the kleptocracy was used to shut down oil and gas development. There were a number of other things. It wasn't just political, it was cultural, and it's a real challenge. So I got out of Russia. We brought 5,000 ecotourists into the Bering Sea area, did a whole lot of very cool things, led a delegation that went to their closest nuclear power plant to us on environmental security issues, played the environmental security card a lot. Yeah. Then I found myself later on in trying to induce investment in the Arctic a couple of ways. I was chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, and a large part of what we had to do was convince the military to come back into the Arctic, to look at the what a newly accessible Arctic would mean for Arctic security, which is huge. I probably have testified before Congress more than anybody else on the need for icebreakers. Then I found myself in the private investment field after developing a couple of tech companies and raising money with Hugh Short for the first private equity fund focused on the Arctic. Every single one of these things, whether it's taking advantage of our opportunities in the 80s, in the 90s, security is a big element. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a security picture that says stability, the Arctic is a good place to invest. Only 5 million of us live here, okay? And that's including big cities in Russia above the Arctic Circle. Only 5 million of us live here, and we don't have enough money stuffed in our mattresses to meet the $1 trillion investment goal that Scott Minard and a group of the World Economic Forum found that we need. We've got to have a good security picture.
So let's build up to that then, because I want to try to crescendo in the opportunities that the Arctic provides in a cooperative nature in order to both fill this investment gap, but also what that investment gap might cover and how that relates to security. But I think we have to overlay the geopolitical environment now. You did a nice job sort of covering what some of that looked like in the 80s and then into the 90s, the Soviet Union collapse, and there was an opportunity perhaps to invest in Russia, work with Russia, and then call it a roughly 10-year period where that came, went, the dynamics began to change in what is now the Russian Federation. They're certainly different today.
Right.
Certainly different today, as we've seen in major geopolitical events. I mean, it's not possible to do much of what maybe was attempted in the past.
The period of 1988 to about 2014, 2015 will be seen as the light in the dark ages. We've had essentially a century of history where the Russians have not wanted to play in the world market economy in a way that brings investment in and out. And it's sad. It frankly is sad for residents of the Arctic. It's sad for the families who have members of their family both in Alaska and Russia or other places. And it's sad for the world, right, that in building the rule of law, somebody has decided, well, that's not important. Let's just start bombing cities and, you know, putting people's apartments on fire. It makes no sense.
And so now we have a much different picture, a much different chessboard that we're looking at. Not only are we dealing with a different Russia from what you experienced in that time that you defined, but there's also China now, and there's Russia and China involved in this, which I think if we bring it back to security, we're looking at this now as that U.S.-Russia, U.S.-China, and U.S.-Russia-China in the context of the Arctic. So let's focus in on the Pacific sphere of this, because here we are in this part of the Arctic.
Sure.
Alaska has an Indo-Pacific orientation to it by virtue of its geography. We're looking into the Pacific region, which is where Russia and China have operated together as recently as within the last few weeks. Now, to the extent of how well they're integrated, that's for a different conversation, but we see them at least signaling a willingness for them to work together in some capacity in and near the Arctic region. Now, I know, Mead, some of the work that you've done in this particular part of the world, but I think it might be interesting to some other people to find out what Alaska's connection is to the Indo-Pacific. And maybe you could talk first from the investment standpoint, Alaska, Japan, Alaska, Korea, but then flip that around and say, why is Japan interested in this region? Why is Korea interested in the region? And maybe what are the opportunities that the U.S. has to leverage that from a cooperative nature to ensure security in this part of the world?
Well, I can go into depth and say when Pan Am was founded way back in the 20s, 30s, and international aviation was there, one trip hired Charles Lindbergh and his wife, and they actually wrote a book about it called North of the Orient. And they left New York City. They flew north over the Canadian Shield, came through Alaska, landed in what is now Pravidelnia. And then they hired Vilmar Stefansson, the great Arctic explorer, to go to Moscow to see if Pan Am could have overflight rights so that they could go essentially the Great Circle route from New York to Tokyo, New York to China. And the Russians said no. And so instead, what Pan Am developed was flying boats going across the Pacific to places like Hawaii and Midway Island. Mm-hmm. Even back then, at the very beginning of Bolshevik Russia, we were thinking about cooperation on aviation. With Japan, 1937, I wrote my college thesis about this. Japan had overfished some areas near the northern Japan, and he authorized fishing ships to come into Bristol Bay, Alaska, the world's richest salmon, the red salmon fishery, and start taking by mechanized means what we were only allowing our fishermen to catch with sailboats.
Wow.
And the entire West Coast longshoremen went on strike. And Roosevelt said, why don't we do a 200-mile limit? And a guy named Alger Hiss at the State Department said, no, that way the Navy can't sail through the Straits of Gibraltar. And so we locked ourselves into 40 years of policy of not being able to protect our fish. After the Second World War, General MacArthur, who was essentially running Japan in the occupation, said to bring this economy out of the ashes, we need a source of wood fiber for textiles. And we put together the sale of timber in the Tongass. They created two pulp mills, one in Ketchikan, one in Sitka, a lumber mill, and we were the main feedstock for the Japanese textile industry. And if you look at any developing country, you usually start with textiles before you go to steel and much more value-added manufacturing. And we were a part of that. So as a guy who came to Alaska in the 70s, I was mentored by Alaska leaders by saying, you got to pay attention to our markets in Asia.
Yeah.
You got to pay attention to this global aviation thing. It's key to Alaska's economy. It still is. And the Japanese, I had a very interesting situation. I was later chair of the Arctic Research Commission. We went to Japan to talk about research cooperation because they've been a tremendous supporter of the International Arctic Research Center in Fairbanks. And we have a lot of common interests in oceans, a lot of common interests in fisheries. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the Japanese have been thinking about northern sea routes in the Arctic for a long time. My first kind of grant that headed the Institute of the North on that was in the late 90s. And so at any rate, the Japanese, I met with a young Japanese Diet member named Yoko Kamikawa. She just finished now being foreign minister of Japan.
Wow.
And I said, if you want no competition as a young Diet member, why don't you start an Arctic caucus? And she did. And it's that group in Japan that thinks through. In fact, they want to come to Alaska next year. My point is this, is that our economic ties have been with Asia.
Yes.
Most of our economy is based on exports of one kind or another. We sell a lot of fish to China. We have sold a lot of energy to Japan. We have services and aviation all over the place. And if we don't pay attention to our Indo-Pacific market or the security picture in the Indo-Pacific, it hurts the Alaska economy. But I'll just say that anything we produce in the Arctic, it can be Russian gas from Yamal, is aiming toward Asian markets. That's where the people are.
So I think a lot of people, in the fact is, I guess, it's not just what people think, the geography would depict that Alaska is what makes the United States an Arctic country, but Alaska is also what makes the United States economically viable in a lot of respects in the Indo-Pacific region. And if that is a fact, or at least has some semblance of a fact, I think then we could look at those who are interested in that investment. You use Japan as an example. We could also throw Korea in there, which I think you've alluded to. Now, then we could say, okay, the United States and Japan also share other things in common with Japan in Korea, and that's in the geopolitical context. Last I checked, Japan and Russia had fought a war just over 100 years ago, and Japan did just fine in that one. Don't typically get along Japanese and the Russians, Japanese and the Chinese, and so on. You get what I'm getting at here is that they are partners in security as well. And so you've outlined some of their interests in the Arctic region. And I'm wondering what we might be able to offer, we, the United States, to Japan and Korea in this part of the world from a security context, because we share this interest in whether it's containing China and its interest in the Arctic region, or managing Russia's ability to, say, potentially monopolize a sea route through the Bering Strait. Russia's trying to get through that, not necessarily get to the United States. They're getting through that to try to get to markets in Asia. So how might we find ways to leverage the opportunities that maybe started as investment relationships but now are emerging into security relationships in the context of the Arctic?
Well, I think I would start with a couple of examples we put forward to expand U.S. presence in the Arctic in cooperation with its with our allies. And let me just start with shipping. I was chair of the Arctic Research Commission. We paid for the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. It was the eight nations, including Russia, who laid out an entire blueprint for marine safety in this newly accessible ocean. Out of that, we got a search and rescue agreement where our militaries work together. We got an oil spill agreement where our Coast Guards work together. We got marine safety agreements where our Coast Guard and the Russians work together today to make sure that our small hunting boats and their large tankers aren't running into each other. So we've worked on marine safety. I like to say we've got the rules, now we need the resources. Mm-hmm. The resources that are missing are ports, icebreakers, and the money to pay for them.
Yeah.
Now, the Russians have a plan. They say, okay, in fact, I've read their plan. They gave it to the Arctic Economic Council. Mm-hmm. 18,000 ships use the Suez Canal. 10% of them would be better off using the Arctic if there were an Arctic seaway. They said they'll be the seaway. They'll charge everybody $500,000 a toll to go across. Mm-hmm. Still saves money. And that's $900 million a year for Russian shipping
services.
And
we're seeing right now how geopolitical events can impact that with the closing of the Suez Canal, but with the Houthis.
Exactly.
The shipping through the Red Sea.
And there's some other problems in the Suez Canal, and there are a lot of problems in the Panama Canal.
The Ever Given going sideways, closing that off, how might that benefit?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so, I've had a chance in my career, Matt, to meet with heads of state all over, including ours. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to find an American president, and I've worked with presidents of both parties, who are as versed on Arctic shipping as the president of Korea. You know, and I've been in the room. One president said, "You know, we just got to keep working on this." The deputy foreign minister said to me, "As long as she's president, we're going to be pushing Arctic shipping."
Yeah.
In Japan, you know, we have an 8-member Arctic caucus in our U.S. Senate. They're in the Diet is 64 members,
wow.
And they're thinking about how do they get reliability, and they want to work with the United States. So figuring out a reliable way. The crazy thing about Russia is that I found as an investor there that reliability is one of the hardest things to get.
Yeah.
Whatever it is in that culture, I don't understand. But there's stories of lost trains on the Trans-Siberian and so forth. So the Koreans, the Japanese, and I would even say the Chinese would like to see an internationalization of Arctic shipping. So that we've got the tow trucks, as it were, the icebreakers, in case people break down, that we've got the charting that's necessary. And the Russians have put forward a business model that says, pay us and we'll do it. I don't think we should stand for a Russian monopoly. And that's why I worked with Senator Murkowski, worked with Senator Sullivan, worked with Senator Wicker, Senator Whitehouse, Cantwell, and we created this federal advisory committee to devise this business plan on this. The Biden administration has not set it up yet. They said they're going to. It's required by law. And the concept is, should we help foster the investment in an Arctic Seaway in the same way that we have in the St. Lawrence between the United States and Canada, in the same way that we did for ComSat in creating satellite telephones and satellite TV in the early 60s? And I think we can.
So. I mean, you know where we're at here with the Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies. I can't get political, but okay. I can kind of talk around it a little bit, and you can. So, and what I mean by that is if we look back, say 10 years ago, or maybe 5 years, somewhere in that time span from today, looking back, the United States over the course of multiple administrations, regardless of party, regardless really of who put it forward, has made a lot of progress in terms of policy and personnel when it comes to our nation's Arctic interests. Sure, each one might have a different flavor depending on, you know, who's in charge of what, as would be the case whether it's in business or politics. New national strategy for the Arctic region, a new DoD strategy for the Arctic. Every military service has new or updated strategies. We see a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Arctic. We see an Arctic ambassador. I could go on. The research commission that you served as chair for, the chair of that commission transcends political administrations. You served in multiple as your replacements, or your predecessor served in multiple administrations of different parties. And the people who followed you, same scenario.
Sure.
What I'm getting at is that progress in this part of the world and our nation's Arctic interests have progressed, regardless of who's in the White House, who's in the Pentagon, who's in Foggy Bottom, so on and so forth. But a common theme that is adjacent to that is the need to invest in the region to support our initiatives. So as we look forward now in this geopolitical environment, with Russia being as it is, with China being as it is, with the United States progressing with our national interests, the Arctic is going to continue to have a role, I would argue probably an increasingly vital role in global security and international stability. But what specifically, tangibly, could we do? I mean, I would believe that you would be advising a president, a secretary, regardless of political affiliation, the same things.
Sure.
Regardless of political party. What might some of those be?
Well, I'll just give you one that transcended and both Republican administrations, Democratic administrations did well. Under law of the sea, or traditional international law, we had the right to claim extended continental shelf. That's area outside our 200-mile limit that was geologically part of North America. I pushed during the Bush administration to get that project funded. It cost $80 million to start. It ultimately cost about $120 million. Out of that mapping exercise that we did together with the Canadians through Republican and Democratic administrations, Democrat president Joe Biden, last December, a year ago, made a claim for extended continental shelf that added to the United States area of land twice the size of California. Now, that was essentially a 20-year exercise. It was a mapping exercise. Mm. There was diplomacy involved. There was science involved. But we kept that going. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson did the Louisiana Purchase. Joe Biden did this, but he happened to be the guy who was there when we were ready to make the claim. And I'm glad he made the claim.
Yeah.
A different example is our work with Greenland. You know, there are very few countries in the world, developed countries in the world, that have colonies that have USAID in them. The Trump administration, you know, at the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations, and the Biden administration, we've all basically had the same policy, which is work with the people of Greenland. They're related to Alaskans. They have tremendous opportunities. They have aspirations to be independent, and it's incredibly important to have good local relations when we have a base at Thule that is holding radars that help defend and save the lives of 700 million people in Europe and North America. And so we have had a bipartisan policy that's ended up in having a consulate in Greenland. Trump putting pressure on the Danish government to fund their own airports and not have the Chinese fund the airports.
Yeah.
A celebration I'm going to tomorrow, as this is taped, to celebrate the opening of the new airport in Greenland. And this is all to induce investment in the country and to make it go, and that's been a good bipartisan exercise.
Yeah.
Science and climate science, despite the fact that the media loves to paint the administrations as different, we have done lots of work to build up the infrastructure to better understand what's happening in the Arctic, again, on both administrations. Icebreakers. We held up the Arctic policy that was signed out by George W. Bush in 2009 over two lines in the policy for almost a year. It was whether or not we said the word icebreakers because OMB didn't want to commit to them in the budget, and whether or not we said the words law of the sea because it was a controversial issue. Obama looked at that and they didn't really want to commit to icebreakers. They started to. Trump came in his first address to the Coast Guard Academy said we need 6 to 9 of them. And now we have a bipartisan approach to getting more icebreakers in the Arctic. So the needs of the Arctic transcend a presidential term. So you've got to work with both sides.
It's so it's comforting in a sense to know that Arctic issues can transcend sort of political, changes of political leadership, because ultimately, in order to be successful, it needs to have continuity. There's also been a bit of a recency to this, and so how can we make sure that Arctic transcends sort of time, and that it doesn't be, we're interested, we're not interested, we're interested, because it seems that there's inertia right now. There's like an Arctic identity being reemerged within the United States, in a sense. You're talking to some of the politicals that are interested in, senators from Mississippi, congressmen from Florida, so on.
Rhode Island.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Sure.
But let's talk maybe just to kind of get us towards the end here, age a little bit. What advice might you provide somebody who's getting into the diplomatic space? They're getting into national security. Maybe even they're interested in investment banking or whatnot. What opportunity? What advice might you provide somebody to say, hey, here's an opportunity. Sort of like when you said, I got a recommendation for you. Why don't you start an Arctic caucus?
Sure.
Because there's opportunity there and maybe less competition for you to make your mark. What might you advise somebody who's entering graduate work right now or starting college? How does the Arctic get integrated into that? What might you provide them to say, there's opportunity here for you, whether it's national security, diplomacy, investments, transportation? Because there's not a lot of people in Alaska relative to the population of the United States. So we need to get more people interested outside of the state of Alaska. And there are people who want to get involved in this. Where might you direct them? What advice would you give them?
That's a really good question, and it could be a whole podcast.
Yeah.
But let me just
maybe the next
say this.
Next
I, you know, anybody at my stage of the career thinks about, okay, what would be the title of a book? And one of them is Sourdough Starter. We make sourdough waffles, sourdough pancakes, with some of the same strain of sourdough dough that was a sourdough culture that was brought over the Chilkoot Pass in the gold rush of the late 1800s. In Alaska, we always start stuff. I feel blessed and honored to have been part of starting Arctic cooperation in the 80s as the Soviet Union was opening up more, in the 90s as we had this glorious light in the dark ages of being able to work together as eight Arctic nations to think about this stuff. There's still things that need to be started. And so I would say, come with an entrepreneuring spirit. That kind of sourdough will ferment something and help something grow. Come with an open mind about environment versus development. And the reason why I say that is it is so easy in the lower 48 to say, I'm going to go out and protect Alaska from those Alaskans. Well, you know, I tell people, if you're trying to save the elephants in Africa, you work with the local people who are doing the poaching to make sure that they find another means of work. Yeah. And there's not a whole lot of dialogue between the environment and development side here. And there needs to be. Frankly, I was at a conference on hydrogen last week that blew my mind. And I'm a oil and gas guy.
Yeah.
All right. I've always been very pro decarbonization and am still, and I have several investments in that we're testing in one in northern Canada right now, and we're working on a couple of projects in Alaska. So that will happen. So come in with an open mind that you can work together with people that you might not work with in the lower 48. The native-non-native relationship is just amazing here. Mm-hmm. There's so many opportunities in that area because there are investment vehicles that may not be available to you in Schenectady, New York, to make things happen. Public-private investment, understanding how the state investment banks works, how Ex-Im Bank works, how the foreign banks like Japan's Bank for International Cooperation work, all help foster bringing money into the Arctic. Hmm. And so give me a call. I often give folks advice on this.
Regardless of what you want to do, it's going to require resources, and so you need some sort of investment. You need some local know-how. So whether if you're interested and don't know anybody, find somebody that you know, whether you agree with them or not,
I think a military background is pretty important because the military and security issues work. I didn't have that. My son is a Marine Corps captain. One of my sons is a Marine Corps captain right now, but I had a chance to get involved in missile defense in the late 90s, early 2000s, leading up to the decision to deploy and then the work to deploy missile defense here. And I'll just say that back in the 80s, we talked a whole lot more about strategic issues when it came to Arctic security than we talk about today. Hmm. And yet we have concerns. We have defend our bases. We've got new cruise missile technology that is very hard to identify, and we need better domain awareness. That means we need to know what's coming with some capability to shoot it down. Putin has openly talked about missile defense in Greeley and has said, you know, that's why they're developing hypersonic glide vehicles. Kodiak may well be part of that defense and testing our program. Drones. Right now, each Army installation basically is in charge of its own perimeter defense. Mm-hmm. We are testing some of the best drone technology here in Alaska.
Opportunities for entrepreneurship, for investment
that's the point. You will see these needs. Yeah. And just even going back to one thing you're seeing a huge investment in right now by the government working with private industry is fiber across the Arctic.
Yeah.
Guess what? When we started missile defense in the early 2000s, 20 years ago, we wanted to do a fiber over to Thule Greenland, but Canada wasn't part of the missile defense project. Hmm. So it went differently. And now we're trying to figure out, okay, how do we get Pan-Arctic fiber?
Right.
So the military
a cooperative
and
the effort indeed. Yeah,
not only cooperation between countries, but cooperation between the civil side and the business side.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm very optimistic. I mean, that's the main thing. Some people will say, well, most of what's been done in the Arctic has been done. Uh-uh. It's still tabula rasa in terms of bringing reasonable organization to shipping, even to aviation, which had gotten boring. You know, most of a flight between, say, Seattle and Dubai or Detroit and Shanghai was over the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And now with Ukraine, we can't do those overflights as easily. So we've got to get back to that normalization. And there's a lot of work to be done.
Mead Treadwell, thanks for joining the program.
Matt, good luck with everything you're doing. You've been a wonderful collaborator on thinking strategically here. And bless this institution. We need it.
We'll have you back again. Thanks.